Welcome to 2008. I mean, 2000 great!
We here at Circle A Radio will leave new subjects for our next shows, and tonight we'll update you on some of the things we covered last year. We'll talk with Claude Marks of the Freedom Archives about the San Francisco 8 case, then we'll speak with Lisa Moore, Assistant Dean for Multicultural Affairs at Reed College, about the Gina 6 and Reed's own nuisance incident. And then we'll talk to Eric Ward of the human rights organization Center for New Community about pending anti-immigration legislation, hate crimes, and the relationship between white nationalism and the anti-immigrant movement. Stay tuned.
On Sunday, February 18, 2007, we spoke with journalist and historian Claude Marks about his video, Legacy of Torture, The War Against the Black Liberation Movement. The video tells the story of the San Francisco Eight former Black Liberation Movement members who, in 1971, were accused of killing a police officer in San Francisco. In 1973, 13 alleged black militants were arrested in New Orleans in connection with the events in San Francisco. Some of them were tortured for several days in order to extract testimony. In 1975, a federal court in San Francisco threw out all of the evidence obtained in New Orleans because it had been extracted through torture. In 2005, the same two lead San Francisco Police Department investigators 30 years ago, ordered the case to be reopened. This is Claude Marks.
So we now have eight people charged with a conspiracy that starts in 1968 and goes to 73. And the main part of it is this Ingleside shooting. And the evidence that the government has, essentially, is torture testimony.
In essence, this case has always been one of the cops trying to figure out a way to blame somebody for something that they couldn't solve, which is the murder of a cop in 1971, in a period known to be replete with this COINTELPRO war against the very movement that these people were a part of.
Two of the people charged have been imprisoned for 30-plus years. Jalil Muntakim was arrested before this incident happened in San Francisco, was already in police custody. And Herman Bell, who was arrested in 1973 in New Orleans, has been charged as well. Both of them are parole eligible, doing time in New York State. And in addition to Harold Taylor, Ray Boudreau, Hank Jones, and Richard Brown, our Cisco Torres, who is a brother who was in New York and is fighting extradition, is in Rikers Island. Harold Taylor is still fighting extradition in Panama City.
This is John Bowman, who died in December of 2006. He is one of the San Francisco Eight, and this is from the video, Legacy of Torture.
The same people who tried to kill me in 1973 are the same people who are here today, 2005, trying to destroy me. I mean it literally. I'm very concerned. I'm angry. I don't feel like it's right. I don't feel like it's something that should go unnoticed, or I don't feel like the government should be able to get away with continuously to harass.
It's fairly irrational to think that torture testimony can become viable. But what drives the so-called Justice Department, and in this case also the Attorney General's Office of the State of California, isn't necessarily make sense on any kind of humane level. And so I can't speak to their motives and what drives them. But I do think that the judicial process is being challenged in some very fundamental ways, post 9/11, if they can possibly push the boundaries of what they can get away with, they would like to do it in the same way that fundamental human rights laws are being challenged by the same government and under the same strategic approach, which is that there's no way that anything the U.S. government does or its agents and agencies do can be claimed as being illegal or a breach of any kind of Geneva agreements or anything else. That's what they would like to do, is redefine and, in fact, codify any tool that they choose to use or claim in the name of fighting terrorism, whether it be outside the borders or in the borders.
This is Harold Taylor from the Legacy of Torture video.
They came out with a plastic bag, put it over my head, and they started beating me with the bag over my head. About time I was about to lose consciousness, about to pass out, they'd snatch the bag off. And while I'm trying to catch my breath, they would start beating me again.
The challenge that that represents is that the public needs to say there's no way that's going to happen. Until that kind of movement becomes more vociferous, the question or the decision about whether this kind of torture testimony is legitimate or not is left to prosecutors and judges who were prosecutors to decide, which is not a particularly healthy situation, but it's the situation that we find ourselves in. And so the countervailing force has to be not just one that's fought out within the judicial process, but one that is in fact subjected to public intervention and overview, which is to say, no, this is outrageous. We don't want to live in a society where torture is justifiable, where this level of violence is one that can be carried out with impunity by the cops or the FBI or anybody else. To me, that's in fact what's at issue here. The heart of the matter is we need to take a stand to say that we won't stand for this outrage, irrespective of what their decision-making process is and what drives them to unleash this prosecution against these folks. That's what we need to do, pure and simple. We actually have a different set of values. Our world is more humane than that.
On December 21st, 2007, we spoke to Claude Marx again about the most recent developments in the case of the San Francisco Eight.
I think one of the more significant developments in the San Francisco Eight case is that the judge Moscone in the case heard arguments about bail. And the prosecution, the state of California, was asking for bail to be increased from $3 to $5 million per defendant for six of the eight who are eligible, remembering that Jaleel Muntakim and Herman Bell are still serving sentences of over 30 years from the state of New York. But the other six men are eligible for bail, and in the discussions in court and the arguments around bail, rather than increasing the bail, which the prosecution was asking, Moscone lowered bail to the point where it varied from slightly over $200,000 per person to about $600,000 per person. And because of the kind of movement that we built and the kind of community support that exists around this case and the outrage that people feel about a 36-year-old prosecution based on statements made under torture in 1973, we have ended up with a situation where property has been put up in order to get six of the eight brothers out on bail. That's a major, major victory. What is currently happening is this. There have been a number of hearings held since March, apart from the bail issue, that deal with various legal points, the use of torture statements, the fact that the statute of limitations is being challenged around the conspiracy count in the case. That is something that's going to be argued in January, January 10th being the next significant court date around the San Francisco 8. The delay in bringing forth the prosecution is an issue that is going to be argued. The right of the government to essentially reconstruct the same evidence that was thrown out in the 1970s and bring them forward again today is the larger political question that is faced by us as a support movement. Why is it that this case is being brought today when it was thrown out in the 1970s in two different jurisdictions? And it's that political question that I think is the one that is the most important to talk about, that the legacy of the Black Liberation Movement and the Black Panther Party is what's really being challenged by the government today. And why is that? It's because I believe that they want to put people on notice that organized resistance to this government and its policies, that a contemporary struggle to confront institutional racism, that any kind of progressive force with a potential will be met by a level of repression. It's why COINTELPRO needs to be understood today. COINTELPRO being the government's official program of counterinsurgency, whose purpose was to destroy not only the Black Panther Party, but other similar movements because of their potential to really change public opinion and to really transform some of the infrastructure of empire. And that type of challenge is what ties this case today into all of the other ways that we can see of challenging things from torture and imprisonment, Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, the massive amount of violence that's being perpetrated against prisoners throughout the country, the ways in which conscious movements are being obstructed and attacked, whether it's the Green Scare or the San Francisco 8. That's the kind of larger picture politics that are about a confrontation of ideas and visions. On one, the kind of empire that is willing to wage wars around the world and internally on one hand, and people who are trying to figure out a way to reconstruct progressive movement that's based on a different vision of the world, that's based on more humanitarian values. What will happen on January 10th is, one, the entering of not guilty pleas by the eight brothers. The second thing is that some of these issues about the prosecutorial delay and the validity of a conspiracy count, count number two in the charge against them, for which, one might add, people have already been confronted with these charges, in some cases actually done time around these charges. They're being brought up again under the umbrella of a conspiracy charge that is really the most telling part of this prosecution, having to do with criminalizing the legacy of the Black Panther Party. The issue of this conspiracy charge is going to be challenged by the defense in a number of motions that have been brought forth in writing and will be argued orally in court. So the January 10th court date has to do with the official entering of not guilty pleas and this question of statute of limitations. The April 21st date is the date that's currently scheduled for the beginning of a preliminary hearing. The purpose of a preliminary hearing is to determine whether or not there is sufficient evidence to actually bring the defendants into a trial setting, whether there's enough new material or evidentiary material being put forward by the prosecution that actually warrants a trial happening. Well, I think what we're seeing in this particular era is a tremendous resurgence or a level of entitlement by not only institutions like the government and prosecutorial parts of the government, including the so-called Justice Department of the federal government, but also a resurgence of white supremacy. And that white supremacy and that level of attack, and particularly the ways in which, through everything from gentrification to imprisonment, particularly targets black and brown communities in this country. Gina is one example of many of incidents of racism that are essentially being soft-pedaled, in which, in the case of Gina, once again, the victims themselves are being prosecuted for what is essentially a racist incident in a community that is trying to keep black people in their place, subjugated. And the resistance and the attention given Gina simply reveals the ongoing nature of what white supremacy and racism looks like in the United States. It's not unique. And what is more unique is the way in which a level of spontaneous, particularly black resistance to that form of ongoing repression and racism was able to be mobilized. There's currently, as of November 30th, an international call demanding the dropping of charges in this case, signed by people like a number of Nobel laureates, Desmond Tutu, Mairead Corrigan McGuire. That campaign to internationalize and to give a level of stature to the calls to drop the charges is something that's going to continue to build in the next period of time. So again, that entire call can be read at the Free the SF8 website. It's also important that various communities create forums in which this information can be disseminated. We've done that in Portland in the past and are hoping to come back to Portland again. And in the upcoming period, we're hoping to bring some of the San Francisco Eight brothers themselves. One of the things that I think is significant about who they are and how they move in the world is that one of the intentions of the prosecution is to use the legal attack, their prosecution, as a way to try to bring about disunity among them in the hopes that somebody would start cooperating with what is a very weak legal case for the government. And instead of that happening, because of who they are, their history with one another, and their longtime commitment to doing work, particularly in the black community, but part of the whole social justice commitment that they've made in their lives, rather than a level of disunity, the government has been taken aback by the fact that they've maintained unity among themselves and have had this vision of building a larger movement. Out of the repression comes a level of resistance that is actually very amazing, and who they are, very central to this process, are people who have a very long-standing history with challenging the inequities of the United States.
That was Claude Marx, one of the directors and producers of Legacy of Torture, The War Against the Black Liberation Movement. You can be kept up to date on this case at www.freethesf8.org. And you're listening to Circle A Radio at KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Tonight we're updating you on stories we covered in 2007. On September 5th, 2007, Circle A Radio produced a show about the Gina Six. We talked to Portlanders Kevin Fuller, founder and executive director of the Bridge Builders, and Alpha Tasema, a junior at Jesuit High School and a member of the Perspective Gents, who sponsored a Gina Six fundraiser and vigil on September 20th in Portland.
I'm Alpha Tasema. I go to Jesuit High School. I'm a junior, 16 years old.
I'm Kevin Fuller, executive director of the Bridge Builders. I became familiar with the Gina Six case through Black Talk Radio, Tom Joyner, Michael Baisden, morning shows. And after that, I went on the internet, and then I began to read a lot of the information that was being sent and transmitted as they were forming the march that was to occur in Gina, Louisiana on September 20th.
I heard about it through my director, the director of the Perspective Gents Club, Mr. Kevin Fuller. He introduced those of us who didn't know about it, about this Gina Six issue.
Bridge Builders for the past 2 years have had a theme of a candle in the dark. And that concept came from Dr. Benjamin Elijah Mays, who happened to be the mentor to Dr. Martin Luther King when he was a student at Morehouse College. The concept of a candle in the dark is motivating and encouraging people to illuminate flames of hope in dark situations. And so for the past 2 years, the Perspective Gents Club have been looking at areas of darkness. So we use that concept for the Gina Six situation as Color of Change was challenging people in different cities to have different events to bring light to the situation. So the concept of the Candle in the Dark vigil came from a mission that the Perspective Gents were already charged with, and then it ended with a peace walk where they took about a 1 mile trek up and down Martin Luther King, which was appropriate because we were using Dr. King's quotes for much of the ceremony. There were about 300 people at the event, and we collected about $1,500 to send to the defense fund. But it really served as sort of a beginning for the Perspective Gents to realize that they could have impact. And if within 72 hours they could get the community to come out, they figured that they could probably do more. They had more time to plan.
The Gina Six refers to a group of six black teenagers who were charged with the beating of a white teenager at Gina High School in Gina, Louisiana, on December 4, 2006, although the incident began on September 1, 2006, when three white students hung nooses on a tree at Gina High School in order to intimidate black students from sitting under what they called the, quote, white tree. The three were suspended from school but were never criminally charged. The six black students were originally charged with attempted second-degree murder. The website, freethegina6.org, has background information on the case. On December 3, 2007, defendant Michael Bell reached a plea deal with the prosecutors. Bell pleaded guilty to a juvenile charge of second-degree battery in return for a deal that gave him credit for the 10 months he had already served. Without the deal, the 17-year-old faced being placed in a juvenile facility until his 21st birthday. He is expected to be released by June. On December 21st, members of the Congressional Black Caucus called on Louisiana Governor Kathleen Blanco to pardon Michael Bell and five other teenagers, known as the Gina Six. And in other news about Gina, Louisiana, the Nationalist Movement, a white supremacist group which describes itself as, quote, pro-majority, will hold a rally in Gina, Louisiana on Martin Luther King Jr. Day. The events planned include a parade, speeches, ceremonies, and petitions, quote, as a centerpiece to abolish King Day, unquote. Again, this is Alpha Tasema.
There's this idea that you just want to, specifically coming from the white kids, they just want to push it on the side and they're all crazy. Forget about that. And it's far away. It's all the way in Louisiana. So why do we have to worry about that? Why do we have to waste our time? That's kind of what I saw.
And in contrast, what about the other African-American kids?
Oh, everyone got mad. Oh, especially when I told them about the nooses. Everyone was just fired up. But no one that I told at my school went to the vigil. Just because I think they had that going to Jesuit, I guess that idea of forget about it, it's cool, everything's fine here, why do we have to worry about that, kind of rubbed off on them.
From the 1880s to the 1960s, at least 4,700 men and women were lynched in this country. In the past decade or so, about a dozen noose incidents a year came to the attention of civil rights groups. But since the huge September 20th rally in Genoa, Louisiana, this country has seen a rash of as many as 50 to 60 noose incidents. We spoke with Lisa Moore on December 23rd about the noose incident at Reed College in southeast Portland.
I'm Lisa Moore, and I'm the Assistant Dean of Multicultural Affairs at Reed College. Small liberal arts college, has a population of about 1,300 students, and it focuses on undergraduate education. I had heard about the Gina 6 over the summer, when actually I was teaching an anti-racism course in Massachusetts at Smith College. So, I mean, that was sort of when I had heard about it, and there had been a lot of chat about it on the different diversity professional listservs. So I heard about that, and I said, wow, it's just unbelievable the punishments that were being doled out to the students involved with Gina 6. And so kept track of that. There were quite a few students at Reed who were really active in terms of educating students in the Reed community once classes started about what was happening down in Louisiana. So there was efforts by students and certainly by our Black and African Student Union around raising consciousness on campus about Gina 6, as well as we have this one student group called the Blue Heron Info Shop. And they have been doing a lot of lunchtime activism, going up to people's tables and saying, hey, do you know about Gina 6? I think the fact that there had been sort of previous consciousness raising happening on campus was really positive. And I think that's part of why people were so surprised when we had our own issue that happened over Halloween. Some students put up some effigies hung by nooses on Elliott Circle, which is the main part of campus. The president of the college saw them and immediately took them down. But it sparked a lot of conversation, a lot of debate. People were very upset that these nooses basically had been hung on campus. When the student was confronted by another administrator on campus, the student said, well, it wasn't intentional. This wasn't about racism or anything. I was just hanging these up for a Halloween project. Then the debate started. Like, don't you know the significance of the noose? Like, don't you know the significance of having even dummies hanging from trees by nooses? And that kicked off this massive amount of conversation on campus about it, resulting in me writing a pretty poignant letter to campus. I sort of started out talking about what's happening on campus in terms of our tone and sort of what's happening in terms of higher education in general, because there have been a lot of these noose incidents and other things happening on college campuses lately around issues of civility. And a lot of the things in my letter really focused on why can't people who have issues with things that they find offensive speak out? And why is it so difficult for them to speak out, but it's so easy for people to actively offend? So I talked a lot about that in the letter and about my concerns that when people have an opposing viewpoint, they're finding it really difficult to speak out. And that's really unfortunate. And what can we do about that? Why aren't people thinking more deeply about how their actions impact what people say and how people speak? The intent of the letter to me was really to try to sort of challenge campus to sort of spend some time reflecting about whose voices are being heard and why is it, you know, issues of, you know, comedic irony seem to be acceptable. Because I think in some ways, a lot of the students I work with, you know, and myself included, you know, we were sort of raised on South Park and Sarah Silverman and Dave Chappelle. And I think our parents were raised with, you know, Richard Pryor and all these folks. And so, but I feel like a lot of times students will, you know, they're playing with this stuff. And even though they're young adults, they're still playing and trying to figure out, well, how far can I push the envelope on saying something that's offensive, but I'm really meaning to be ironic with it. A lot of what I wrote about in this letter was that, you know, sometimes it's not funny and sometimes it's not about trying to be the wittiest person in the room. Sometimes it really is about hurting people and you have to think about that. A lot of our conversations ended up being very focused on how people were treating each other in the course of having discussions. And a lot of students were just sort of in disbelief because there had been education going on campus about the genus 6. So a lot of students were like, well, how could they not know the significance of the noose given that these different groups on campus were bringing attention to genus 6? How could you not know that even for something like a Halloween prank, how could you not know the significance? And so as a result, there were a lot of students on campus who had a lot of really passionate feelings, as well as like staff and faculty. And so I would say that in terms of Reed's campus and issues around racism and anti-racism specifically, it's definitely been amped up quite a bit. There have been a lot of new student groups that have been started in response to it, which has been exciting. And what's been really great is sort of seeing the cross-racial alliances that have been happening around sort of resisting and sort of pushing people to sort of think a little bit harder about their actions. There is a new student group called Raucus. A group of freshmen actually started it, and they just said, well, we want to talk about these issues, and we need to educate people. And so they're doing all sorts of really interesting projects around having food share nights where people come in and share their food and talk about various different issues associated with, you know, racism and anti-racism work and talking about oppression. Last year, we had a Black and African Student Union that was created, as well as an Asian Student Union. So for a lot of colleges, these groups have existed since 1968, and Reed has its own legacy with 1968. But after 1968, a lot of this stuff actually died down. A lot of it disappeared. The resurgence of it back on campus has been very exciting. And I think even though circumstances under which I had to write this letter were unfortunate, I think that the dialogue that's happened has been really, really great. You know, and even when it's been negative, you know, I'd say that of the 92 emails I got from staff and faculty and students in response to the letter, I'd say maybe only 4 or 5 were really over the top, mean, or nasty. And even with those individuals, I emailed them back and we had conversations back and forth on email, and it was actually really positive. So even though I think the sort of the disembodiment of electronic communication can be really difficult in terms of having serious confrontations about issues, I also think it has opened up the space to talk to the people who maybe you couldn't get through by talking to face to face. I think there are certain history lessons that aren't being taught, and I think we're seeing sort of a shift in terms of how students are learning about the past. One of the aspects of what happened at Reed that was so painful to me personally was the fact that I probably spent as much time explaining the significance of the noose to Black students on campus as I did to white students. It's not as if this is isolated to just, oh, white people don't know about the noose. There's actually something happening in terms of how students of color I work with, in terms of what's being communicated. I mean, I think people have always been really critical of education and critical of histories that have been taught. But I think in the past, there's always been a sort of assumption by many of us who do diversity work professionally that, well, students of color, your parents and your families are telling you about this stuff, so you're going to be okay, because even if you don't get it in school, you're going to at least get some understandings about the violence of certain things. And what I'm coming up against is that actually that's really changing. And I think that's reflective in terms of people. There is a growing middle class in Black America. And I think when one becomes middle class or upper middle class, there are certain things you lose. There's certain access to things you lose because you're sort of in that mode of trying to strive and be better. And all of a sudden you forgot, oh yeah, the noose. Yeah, like, you know, only like, you know, 50, 60 years ago, people were being lynched by these things. And that's actually really significant. And oh, there's that piece of it. And I also think the other piece of it is that when I think about the students who are in college now, who were sort of in the 18 to 21 year old range, so sort of traditionally aged students, a lot of them grew up in the 90s. And so a lot of them have been exposed to lots of war, Gulf War, Iraq. And so this is a generation of kids who have a really different relationship to these issues because of what they're not being taught and also sort of the world around them. You know, I grew up during Reagan. So, I mean, everything was charged and I heard lots of Black people talking about how racist Reagan was. And I don't think, you know, this generation necessarily has that. It's been different for them. The reaction from different individuals who are representing organizations in Greater Portland, such as the NAACP and the Urban League, like those folks have been really amazing in terms of calling me and writing me and saying, oh, well, what can we do to help support you? Because we can't have this happening at a school in Portland, and we need to make sure our kids and our people are taken care of. It's a button for people right now. And I think that a lot of people are trying to figure out, like, well, why is this happening again? And I don't even necessarily think it's happening again. It's never stopped happening. There's something about the overtness of it recently that I think has really touched people in a different way. And I think maybe because you have Gina 6 happening and you have the immigration debates going on, there's this heightened sense of feeling targeted and experiencing being targeted as a person of color. I know from where I sit, you know, like I definitely have come from, you know, some privilege, right? Like, so I've been able to go to these fancy schmancy colleges and universities, and I'm getting a doctorate degree. So, I mean, there's a certain level of privilege I have. And I think there are a lot of other folks of color who may be in similar situations who are sort of striving. And I think what's happening as we sort of go through these colleges and these elite institutions, we're realizing that, oh, it exists in these places too. It may look and sound different, but it's happening here. And I think that there's something about the Bush administration that has made it permissible for people to be overtly hostile to other people. I think people say, well, I'm just anti-PC and I'm anti-politically correct. And I think that has become, unfortunately, another way to code, oh, I can be as offensive as I want to be. And I think some people would totally disagree with me on it and say, no, no, that's not the case, Lisa. It's not about that. I just don't want to feel like constrained by the limitations of politically correct language. And I'm like, no, I actually think that some of it is that some people have been given permission to be offensive. PC backlash, I think, is in some way to blame for it. There's actually a really good book called Without Sanctuary. It's actually a book of postcards of lynchings from the South, because they used to create postcards of lynchings that would happen in the South. And there's actually a website that accompanies it that's really wonderful. So I highly recommend people checking that out. Or if you want to see a good video that's just about sort of, you know, the construction of race, Race, the Power of an Illusion, it had been on PBS like several years ago. I use it frequently for trainings, and so I would recommend that. And so, yeah, and of course, Reed will have Black History Month coming up in February, as we always do, and there's going to be a pretty good lineup. I mean, I think we for sure have Mary Frances Berry coming, which will be, you know, it's timely, given the various things that have been happening in the world. I think the city of Portland and how the city of Portland sort of responds to these very different issues of immigration and incidents of racism that happen in the greater community, I think it's really important that everybody try to be really reflective about where they're positioned in terms of how they criticize or how they talk about how people should respond or what they should do. Because I think ultimately we're all sort of trying to figure out how to do this well. And I don't think any of us do it really well. I think we're always fumbling. If there was a really great way of doing it, we wouldn't have these issues, right?
That was Lisa Moore, Assistant Dean of Multicultural Affairs at Reed College in Portland. On October 17th, Circle A Radio broadcast a show about community resistance to the neo-Nazi group Hammerskin Nations gathering in Portland. We spoke to Eric Ward, the field director of the Center for New Community, based in Chicago, Illinois. He talked about the relationship between white nationalism and the recent anti-immigrant backlash.
I think we need to be clear and be honest that the modern face of white supremacy today is the anti-immigrant movement in the United States, and it's active in Oregon, and people need to respond to what's going on in their own community. Most Americans don't like overt bigotry. We don't like swastikas. We don't like burning crosses. But what they've figured out is if you take that same bigotry and put it in code, then we'll drink it up, as my niece says, like grape Kool-Aid. And so they don't have to talk about race. All they have to do is talk about immigration. What they know is that when they say the word immigration, that the majority of Americans are not visualizing Canadians coming down from the north.
that what they're visualizing is brown-skinned people coming up from the South. In this, the white nationalist movement has figured out how to have a debate on racism without ever bringing up the word race.
On December 24th, we talked to Eric Ward again about the increased incidence of hate crimes in 2007 and the human rights struggle against pending anti-immigration legislation.
My name is Eric Ward, and I'm the National Field Director with the Center for New Community, a national civil rights organization based in Chicago, Illinois. A lot of our work recently has been around tracking and helping communities respond to both anti-immigrant activity and to hate crimes and intimidation targeting individuals because of their race, religion, gender, sexual orientation. I think we can talk a little bit from, the aftermath of the trials of Jenna 6, the arrest, where, reported incidences around nooses, for instance, have been over 500 just since the rally. I would track that with nationally about 20 incidences in regards to nooses the year before. In regards to anti-immigrant activity, we've tracked a growth of anti-immigrant organizations across the United States, over 600% growth in over the last year. We're seeing the targeting of immigrants and refugees and Latinos who are perceived to be immigrants and refugees across the country, rise in hate crimes, issues of discrimination. What you're seeing right now is a politically charged environment where individuals now feel that they have permission to act out their prejudices and their bigotry on the Latino and immigrant community.
So why now? Why 2007 is all of this stuff coming to a head?
I think that it's the culmination of organizing by the anti-immigrant movement, in particular the Federation for American Immigration Reform, which started back in 1973 in kind of building this kind of political climate. It's clear from anti-immigrant organizations that their strategy is one of attrition. They've been very clear that their goal is to make it unlivable for immigrant and refugee communities in the United States so bad, they said that immigrants and refugees will leave the country and return home. I think you're seeing that in the level of anti-immigrant rhetoric that continues to humanize immigrants and refugees, and you're seeing it with the passage of anti-immigrant legislation around the country. Part of the goal of attrition is really twofold. So, to increase the level of tension for immigrant and refugee communities, to put them in a environment of fear. The other is to put pressure on those who really embrace human rights, who would normally help immigrants and refugees, to put pressure on them to back off. And so I think you're seeing that in Oregon under the auspices of an organization called Oregonians for Immigration Reform, who recently have submitted the Respect for Law Act initiative in Oregon. And what you will see is that come in the new year, that they will begin to collect signatures on this initiative. What's important to remember about this initiative is that basically it seeks to create two types of citizens in the state of Oregon, two different sets of rights for individuals. And it seeks to demonize immigrants. It also seeks to make the community prove their citizenship status, their legal status, before they can receive federally mandated rights, whether it is the right to drive or, whether it's receiving food stamps or emergency medical care for your children. Basically, it's the attempt to drive immigrants and refugees further into the shadow so that they can be exploited, so that they can be vulnerable, so they're less likely to report to law enforcement when they are victims of hate, violence, and discrimination, so that they are more likely not to speak out for their rights in American society.
You know, I saw some of the folks from OFER stand up and testify as to why people without documents should not have licenses here in Oregon. And one of the things they always start their speaking out with is, I'm not a racist. Can you address how race is being used in the immigration debate?
You know, I think we can. I think we can look at the national organizations. I think we can go to the most influential organization, again, the Federation for American Immigration Reform, which is kind of the national umbrella for most of the anti-immigrant organizing that's going on around the country. We can look at John Tanton, for instance, the founder, who has made, you know, overtly racist statement, you know, that the Federation for American Immigration Reform itself has accepted $1.2 million from the White Supremacist Pioneer Fund. You know, we don't remember, but back in the 20s and 30s, the Pioneer Fund was actually peddling German Nazi films in public schools. You know, this is the same group that funded the Bell Curve, which purported to show that blacks were less intelligent than whites. It's a hardcore eugenicist foundation. Federation for American Immigration Reform, its former Western Regional Coordinator, Rick Altman, was also purported to be a member of the Council of Conservative Citizens, the reconstituted White Citizens Councils that were active in the 1960s fighting segregation. Everywhere you look within the anti-immigrant movement, what you see is a hardcore white nationalist leadership who are very clear that this is simply not about immigration, but that this is a backlash on the winds of the civil rights movement. And it should not surprise us that two of the biggest pushes of the anti-immigrant movement nationally are the attacks on the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, which was won through the Civil War, and then also its attack on voting rights, particularly the 1965 Voting Rights Act and the 1965 Immigrant Rights Act, which dismantled white supremacy and immigration law.
So what are people doing around the country to fight against the anti-immigration legislation?
I think that people have had enough. I mean, from social change and community organizers, I think, to even everyday folks, you know, have had enough, I think, of the lies and the rhetoric for the Federation for American Immigration Reform, for Oregonians for Immigration Reform. I think that people have seen, for instance, that these individuals are tearing our country apart, and they are dividing neighborhoods, they're dividing communities, and they're dividing states. And so what we're seeing are that individuals are starting to come together. They're beginning to educate themselves on the truth regarding these anti-immigrant organizations. They're beginning to hold them accountable. They're doing this by speaking to their neighbors, by engaging in educational campaigns like the Campaign for UnitedAmerica.org, which has been bringing people around the country. You are seeing individuals coming together to fight against the public policy abuses that seek to dehumanize immigrants, such as the immigration custom enforcement raids, which are tearing families apart and punishing the victims of exploitation in our society. And I think that what we understand is that in this battle of attrition that the anti-immigrant movement has created, that the way we win is actually through enduring, by building long-term relationships, by building organizations on the ground that are willing to stand up for human rights, that understand ultimately that why the anti-immigrant movement claims that it really is just fighting things that are illegal, that all of us understand that there are many times just because something is legal or illegal doesn't make it right. What happened to the Jewish community in Europe under the hands of the Nazi movement in World War II was all legal, and fighting against it was illegal. And that often we do things that are illegal because it's morally right. And what's morally right now is to stand up against the hysteria of anti-immigrant bigotry. think that one thing people can do specifically, you know, is to form in their city or in their county a network of 10 friends, 10 friends who really see that the anti-immigrant movement seeks to change the very nature of civil rights and human rights in the United States, and that these 10 friends can come together, look at the anti-immigrant activity that is going on in their community, and pick one thing that they think that they can do to make a difference, whether it's speaking out the truth at anti-immigrant movements, whether it's holding political and elected officials accountable for embracing the anti-immigrant movement, whether it's standing outside immigration custom enforcement and letting everyday folks know what is the impact of dividing these communities, that really the important thing we can do right now is to bring together those we work with and choose one project we think would make a difference.
Many thanks to Eric Ward. For more information, check out www.buildingdemocracy.org and www.campaignforaunitedamerica.org. And locally, if you'd like to get involved in the organizing against upcoming anti-immigrant ballot initiatives, contact the Center for Intercultural Organizing, 503-287-4117. For every two adults detained in immigration raids, a child is left behind. Two-thirds of these children are U.S. citizens. More than a third are under 6 years old, and nearly two-thirds are under 11. Children face short and long-term psychological damage when they are separated from one or both parents. This damage can include depression, post-traumatic stress, anxiety, feelings of abandonment, and suicidal thoughts. An estimated 10% of people detained in raids face criminal charges, the majority of which are for false documentation. Children also are impacted economically due to loss of family income if one parent is detained. This information comes from a new report from the National Council of La Raza and the Urban Institute titled "Paying the Price: The Impact of Immigration Raids on America's Children." In addition to an increase in raids on homes and workplaces, a variety of local initiatives to make life more difficult for immigrants, especially undocumented immigrants, have appeared in Oregon. On November 16th, Governor Kulongowski signed an executive order which will require proof of legal residence and a valid Social Security card to obtain a driver's license. At a public hearing on December 18th, community members spoke out.
I am here to say that not giving a driving license to those with no social security numbers is wrong. I know I am just a kid, but I still think it's wrong not to give license to people with no social security numbers, because some of my relatives and friends won't be able to get a driving license. My parents are teachers and both work hard to help all of their students. My mother voted for Mr. Kulongowski because she thought that our governor was going to protect all races, and I am sad to say that he is not trustworthy anymore. Please give driving license to all. I am American too, and I want everybody to do good things, even though there are different colors. We are not terrorists like many people are saying. God made us the same from inside. There are the acts that make us different.
we're going to mobilize, we're going to educate people, we're going to inform people, and we're going to start building alliances and coalitions to really go after the fact that, you know, we contribute economically to this state. We contribute to the taxes. We're tax-paying people. We're hardworking people. We're the backbone of the agriculture industry of the state, and we deserve respect. Right? This is about respect for immigrants who have made the state of Oregon prosper. For a law, a major policy change to take place in less than a month with no outreach to the community is absurd. It's a slap in the face of the Latino community.
Yo que soy campesina, yo a veces me muevo hasta Albany, puedo ir a estarme moviendo en todo el estado.
Myself, as a farm worker, I have to go to Albany and I have to go to many places.
Ahora nos están empujando a ser criminales.
Therefore, they are obligating us to become criminals.
En el aspecto de que es un crimen manejar sin licencia y sin aseguranza.
Because it is a crime to drive without a driver license and without insurance.
Y esa es una necesidad, es una prioridad. Esto es un efecto en dominó, porque no solo es quitarnos las licencias, sino que al no poder tener licencia no vamos a poder trabajar ni alimentar a nuestra familia.
And this is going to have a domino effect, because in not being able to work, we will not be able to feed our families.
Ahora quiero que me miren bien. Yo soy campesina. No soy terrorista.
I would like you to take a good look at me, because I am just a farm worker. I am not a terrorist.
On December 31st, the Oregon Public Safety Coalition delivered over 5,000 petition signatures to the Oregon DMV in Salem, requesting a delay of 1 year in implementing the new licensing regulations. Ramon Ramirez, president of Northwest Tree Planters and Farm Workers United, says the coalition is focusing on educating communities about the new regulations and planning to exert pressure in upcoming legislative sessions.
The fight hasn't ended. The fight just started. You know, we're looking at maybe in the 208 session, maybe in the 209 session, going back and winning driver's license for everybody.
For more information on how you can support, contact Erica Steinbauer, coordinator of CAUSA, 503-984-6816.
Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. The wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door.
You've been listening to Circle A Radio. Thanks to Claude Marks, Lisa Moore, and Eric Ward. For more information, you can find links on our webpage at kboo.fm/Circle A Radio. Circle A Radio broadcasts at 6 p.m. every first and third Wednesday on your community radio station, KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland. You can contact us at circlearadio@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.